You and Me Both is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello.
So good to see you in person, so to speak.
As they say down south, we're glad to be seen and not viewed.
Well, you know, those viewings can be quite entertaining. Well, I've been to a lot.
They can now.
Yeah, well, you know, I went to one viewing where I don't know exactly what happened, but a leg shot up.
Have mercy.
Yeah. Now, she was clearly no longer of this world, but there was something that caused that leg to go up.
That's right. And I bet you some leg went out the door and out the window, too.
That's right. Yes, help, sir. Help.
Help. That's right. Lord, mercy.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and this is You and Me Both, where I get into some of today's biggest questions with all kinds of amazing people. Some of them I've known for years, others I'm meeting for the first time in front of this microphone. Today, we're talking about faith. For me, it's a deeply personal subject, but it's also something that informs my politics. So I wanted to speak to three people who are exploring questions of faith in powerful ways. I'm going to talk with Krista Tippett, longtime host of a public radio show that I have listened to for years called On Being. And I'll also be talking to actor and comedian Asif Manvi, perhaps best known as The Daily Show's, quote, Muslim correspondent. And now let's get right into it with my friend, the Reverend Dr. William Barber. So I am absolutely delighted to welcome the Reverend Dr. William Barber II. He's not only been a pastor in North Carolina for a lot of years, but he became even better known for organizing the Moral Monday movement. He serves as president of Repairers of the Breach, one of my favorite biblical phrases. He co-chairs the Poor People's Campaign, which is intentionally a reminder of the work that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was doing when he was murdered. He was awarded, you know, one of those MacArthur genius grants.
While I was in jail, by the way.
Can you imagine? Hey, Barbara, you got a call?
That's how it happened. That's exactly how it happened. I was in handcuffs sitting on the bus, paddy wagon. Yeah. And they started talking on the bus and said, "You just what?"
Well, your life has been one interesting and challenging experience, my friend. But I want to start really at the beginning. Both of your parents were ministers, weren't they? And in addition to their faith work, they helped to desegregate schools in North Carolina. How did your childhood shape your faith?
Well, thank you so much, Secretary Clinton. And that's my Southern way coming out. You know, we taught to say, "Yes, ma'am, Secretary Clinton." I might get around to saying Hillary, but it's just a thing because I'm from the South. My parents, my father was a minister. My mother was a minister of music. She's a concert pianist who spent a lot of time training young students. She's still living, just retired recently from the school she desegregated after more than 52 years of service. She's a real feisty woman. I asked her, after 50 years, why don't you retire? She said, first of all, mind your business. And the second thing is, she said, when I came here, they didn't want me here. Now I'm going to stay here till I feel like leaving.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my parents accepted a call to come from Indiana back home, my father's home. They were actually called on by a Black principal who was trying to prepare for desegregation. Now, this was in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
And schools are still not desegregated in Eastern North Carolina. So basically, we were living in violation of the law. I was taught that there was no separation between Jesus and justice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, having said all of that, my father was more progressive than a lot of people in the church. Like Dr. King, he faced some isolation. And I decided at an age I didn't really want to have anything to do with ministry. I would be in church, but not ministry. I told my daddy, I might be a good deacon, but I want to reserve the right to tell people just what I feel.
Yes.
And pastors can't always do that because we still have to minister to people. And so I went to school to be a lawyer. And in my junior year, I received a real sense of calling. And when I told my father about it, he said, come home, let's talk. And we went on a 4-hour drive and just talking about whether or not I could do better inside the formal church or outside the formal church, and wrestled through that. And then I preached my trial sermon in March of 1984. The day I preached my trial sermon, some people came to me and said, oh my goodness, you're such a great preacher. Our church has an opening. My daddy looked at me and took me home. He said, you better not even think about it. He said, you're going to seminary. So I finished my senior year at North Carolina Central, the student government president and so forth, and went straight to seminary, Duke University Seminary in 1985.
You know, to say that Jesus and justice are the same thing seems to me to be so obvious. I mean, how can you be a Bible reading person, a church attending person, and not understand how profoundly true that, you know, simple phrase really is? And yet you've spent decades now preaching and being an activist. How are you trying to open up people's minds and hearts to understand what Christianity should mean and what should be expected of us who claim to be followers of Jesus?
Well, let's prosecute case a little bit and do a little theology and admit from at least Western culture and American culture, we have two great problems that have affected and infected theology in a bad way. And that is the genocide of First Nation people and the enslavement of African Americans that were all rooted in racism. And interestingly enough, the exclusion and oppression of women, right? Now, to do those three things, there had to be a misinterpretation of scripture, because you're right. If you read the Bible, there are over 2,000 scriptures in the Bible that talk about how you should do justice, how you should treat the least of these, how you should treat the poor, the sick, the children, the women, and the immigrant. Jesus started his ministry to the poor, his public ministry, his first sermon, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me to preach good news to the poor. And the word for poor there is potokos. It's one of three words in Greek. That word potokos literally means those who have been made poor through political exploitation. Then when Jesus is dying or preparing to die, he said, the nations will be judged by when I was hungry, when I was sick, when I was an immigrant. The text actually said, did you welcome me? Right? Now, how is it that so many folk claim then to be quote unquote Christians, but then have been anti-immigrant, anti the freedom of Black people, anti the liberation of women, anti treatment of indigenous people, right? Well, in order to do that, somebody had to twist the scriptures. So one of my professors said, to be a Christian, to be born again, sprinkled, whatever you call it, and to claim the Holy Spirit is to have a quarrel with the world's systems of injustice. And if whatever you claim you have doesn't produce a quarrel with injustice, then your claim of it being the Spirit with the big S is suspect.
When you think about the very deliberate, concerted effort by one political party to basically try to own Christianity, and it overlooks the role of the African American church, it overlooks, as you say, a lot of theology, a lot of history. It also overlooks this moment in time. You know, Black Lives Matter, I view as, you know, very profoundly a theological statement.
It is.
And when you think about what's happening in our country right now, do you see that maybe we are finally going to have the moral reckoning that has been distorted and perverted and postponed for so long?
You know, I'm thinking a lot about that question because, first of all, historically, you know, not we had slaveholder religion, but we also had Frederick Douglass. We had the religion of the slave. We had the religion of the abolitionists. Let's not forget that.
Yep.
Diverse people coming together to fight against racism is not new. You know, you had the racism in the South, but alongside that, you had Dr. King and so many others who preached the gospel of justice and liberation. So that we've always had these two streams, if you will. Now, I hope so, when you say that about this moment that we're in. And I think it will be a continuation, because in every age has their Edmund Pettus Bridge, right? Every generation has their moment. We've had two reconstructions, one between 1868 and 1896, and then we had the second reconstruction, 1954 to 1968. And I think America needs is in the third reconstruction. I think this is the birth pains of it. When I see all of the organizing, the things that are happening in climate, the Black Lives Matter, Poor People's Campaign, the women's movement that's standing, all of these things coming together. But in this moment, when George Floyd was killed, assassinated, strangled, lynched on a sidewalk, that young girl that kept that camera is the real hero, because she forced us to see it, just like Emmett Till's mama forced us to see his death. Now, the question is, though, is all that we see in the street just about that? And I say it respectfully, I don't think so. The reason is because that happened also during a time of COVID, when we have a lot of death going on and we find out 70-80% of the people didn't have to die if we'd done the right thing. On top of that, we have 700 people dying a day from poverty, even before COVID. So there's a lot of hurt. So I think that when people saw this death and they saw it enacted or carried out by the state, the state is not supposed to kill you. Life is what the state's supposed to protect. And when he said, I can't breathe, I can't breathe, I think internally and spiritually, a lot of people took that as shorthand for how all many people are feeling. Those workers being forced to go into work in lethal environments without protection. I can't breathe. People who are dying in hospitals that shouldn't even be dying. What are probably their last words? I can't breathe. And so there's a sense in which, Secretary Clinton, that the country, that all this movement in the street and all of this coming out is like the democracy trying to breathe, establishment of justice trying to breathe, providing for the common good, promoting general welfare, trying to breathe, saying something's not right here. And I think this moment can be a moment where we come to terms, not just with systemic racism as it affects Black people, but systemic racism in all of its manifestations against brown people, against First Nation people, but also systemic poverty and ecological devastation and the war economy and the false moral narrative of religious nationalism. This is a moment. If we don't miss the moment, if we match our policy decisions to the mourning we see in the street, and if we don't treat this as a spectacle event, rather than recognizing this is a call for reconstruction, this is a moment that we can fundamentally shift. But it's going to require a lot of shift. It's going to require politicians to shift. It's going to require people that may run for office to be moderate, to recognize we're not in a moderate moment. We're in a reconstruction moment. We're in an FDR moment. We are not in normal times. And God help us if we blow this moment. That's where I feel about it.
We're taking a quick break. Stay with us. How do you see now what the church should be doing? Because a lot of people are leaving the church. A lot of young people are leaving the church, in part because the way they understand what Christianity has become is, you know, so judgmental, so alienating, that they think to themselves, well, I don't need that. I don't want to be part of that. So this should also be a time for the church to take a hard look at itself and try to figure out how it can be a real partner in this moment of moral awakening.
So there's a book that when I studied my doctoral degree at Drew University, it was in pastoral care and public policy. And one of the books that was read said that you do not care about your people from a pastoral perspective if you are not willing from a prophetic perspective to challenge the systems that make them have the problems that need pastoral counseling in the first place. So in this moment, we have to stop separating the two. You know, a lot of young people are leaving so-called white evangelicalism. And I was told when we started working with young people, you know, you're not going to be able to be a preacher because they don't like that. I said, no. I said, what they don't like is this bland form of religion that tells them all religion is about is just praying and wishing for stuff. Young people are very open to faith that is about transformation, about love, about justice, about equality, about the essence of what it means to be people of faith. And I think we have to be engaged. There's no way in the days in which we live, the church can stay quarantined inside of the four walls of a building, because that's never what it was intended to do. You know, I've made a pact with some pastors, for instance, and we've said, if anybody in our church dies from the lack of health care, we're going to do just like Emmett Till's mama, called the media in and said, this is what bad government policy looks like. And I'm going to say, how in the world can you claim to follow Jesus, who, if he did anything, he healed everybody free and he never charged a leper a copay? So how?
Never charged a leper a copay.
I mean, really, how do you claim to follow? And I mean, it makes absolutely no sense. See, in our movement, in the Poor People's Campaign, what's attracting people is three things: the counterintuitiveness of it, people coming together, coal miners from Kentucky, black folk from the Delta. Number two, that we are showing the interlocking connection of the injustice. And young folk get this. They love it. They love the moral fusion when you connect the dots, because they understand that. And then number three, what's attracting them is the teaching. Another word I mean by that is, when we go in a room and say, did you know there are 140 million poor, low wealth people? And they said, what? Mm-hmm. And did you know that 66 million of them are white? Did you know about Joseph Stiglitz's book, The Cost of Inequality? They said, what about the cost of inequality? Not what does it cost to fix it, but what's the cost of leaving it the same? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when folks start hearing those numbers and realizing that it doesn't have to be, that these are choices, then they are actually empowered and they're drawn in, because if it's a choice to do it, then we can unchoose.
Absolutely.
We can choose something different.
You know, this year has been a tough year for so many of our fellow Americans. There's so much that has gone wrong, not only the ravages of the pandemic, but the economic devastation, the lost jobs and livelihoods, some of which are not going to come back. A terrible sense of just confusion and loss at the core of our national identity. Would you just say a few words to all of these people who are struggling? You know, how can they keep the faith? How can they regain the faith? How can they understand that, you know, Jesus and justice mean the same thing, if only we are liberated from a political, short-sighted, oppressive religion, and once again, you know, our fellow seekers? How would you, you know, address those who are really hurting right now?
Well, I think that several things. Number one is, I'm reminded of the words of Frederick Douglass when the Dred Scott decision came down in the 1850s, and everybody said it was over. That's it. There's nothing we can do. Slavery is going to be what it is. And he was invited to speak to a women's group in May. And Frederick Douglass said, this decision is monstrous in all of its considerations. But you need to know that every attempt to ally our movement has only served to embolden and intensify our agitation. And what if this moment of pain is a necessary link in the breaking of the chains of oppression? I think we have to remember that people have come through some very, very despairing situations before. And when people ask me, am I optimistic? No. Am I hopeful? Yes. But it's the hope that has to come through the despair. I think the third thing is to recognize that a lot of what we're seeing, even with COVID, is not God-made, it's human ineptitude. And if humans, as James Baldwin said, messed it up, I paraphrase, then we can fix it. The next thing is, remember in history that it was after the swine flu, after all that pain, that Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the New Deal. There is an after this. So I say to folks, in this moment, don't give up. Join up. Join a movement. Join like the Poor People's Campaign. Because every time people have come together in the most difficult moments, whether it was Frederick Douglass, Harriet Tubman, Lucretia Mott, the coming together, they were able to fundamentally shift the direction of history. History is not set. We can affect history. Is it hard? Yes. Is it going to be challenging? Yes. So some of us have decided to say this, Secretary Clinton, that if right now in this moment, within 48 hours, any one of us could be on a ventilator breathing our last breath. If that's the possibility in this moment, then what are we going to do with it? Well, one of the things we can do with it is say, if I knew I only had 2 days to breathe, what kind of world would I fight for with my last breath? What kind of love? What kind of grace? What kind of truth? And then start living like that. All of us, we might live 48 more years. But in this meantime, and I do mean meantime, M-E-A-N, in this meantime, yeah. Right, that we decide that we are not going to join with the meanness, that we're going to use our last breath and everything we have, our activism, our voting, our conversation, our building community, because I don't have any breath to waste. And if I'm going to honor the people who have died and lost their breath, then the only way I can honor them is to use the breath I have to fight for a better world that would not have cost them their life. And I think if we do that, we can, in fact, hew out of this great moment of despair, as King would say, a stone of hope. We can be repairers of the breach. We really can be repairers of the breach, and we can be a movement. Now, it's going to mean we must push. And sometimes that's going to mean your friends are not going to like it necessarily. But it's better to be pushed by a friend to be made better. Black and white and brown and red and yellow and gay and straight, trans, whoever we are this movement. And the last thing we can do is just die.
No, we can't. You are a man after my own heart, my friend. Yep. I mean, that's how I feel every day. And I cannot tell you how much I have loved having this conversation with you. And for those who have listened, who want to hear more from Reverend Dr. William Barber, his sermons at his church are streamed live on Facebook, but there are so many other ways you can find him, his writings, his speaking, his incredible work of purpose and mission on behalf of forming, as our mutual friend John Lewis would say, a beloved community, a community in America that finally lives up to our values and our faith. Thank you so much, my friend. It's wonderful having this chance to talk with you, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Thank you so much.
If you're looking for more wisdom from Reverend Barber, pick up a copy of his new book, We Are Called to Be a Movement. Nearly two decades ago, Krista Tippett recognized that most Americans have a hard time talking about religion and spirituality outside of places of worship. So she started a conversation that continues to this day, not only with religious leaders, but with everyone from poets to physicists. I am so excited to dig into this topic with her. It's just a sheer delight to have this chance to talk with you, Krista.
Oh, well, it's an honor and really a delight to be here.
I particularly resonate to a saying of your describing your own work that I read, where you seek to address what you call a black hole where intelligent public conversation about the religious, spiritual, and moral aspects of human life might be.
Yeah.
Krista, talk to me about how you see this present time. Are we filling the black hole? Are we ignoring it? Where is the opportunity for what I think is a much needed spiritual reckoning about what it means to be human and trying to be more focused in how we live the life we are given, both alone and in company?
Yeah. Well, I do agree with you that as I've watched this moment, I feel that it has brought into relief, it has surfaced, that the questions before us have deep moral content and in fact are about, you know, the soul of our nation. And we still have to develop the muscles and the language and the practices, public practices, to take those things on together. But I think more of us are aware that that's what we're called to do. And theology does have a contribution to make as part of the human enterprise. What does it mean to be human? How do we want to live? And who will we be to each other? Those questions are so alive in our life together right now, between our pandemic and our racial rupture and awakening. I mean, I am really turning now to words and practices that I feel, again, like I would say, are offered up to all of us as part of the human enterprise, of contemplation, of repentance, of redemption, of healing. I was talking to some rabbis the other day about lamentations, right? Like in that tradition, that lamentations is supposed to be a public practice. And I don't know about you, but that word lands so with relief in me.
Mm-hmm.
I want to lament, right? I need to lament, and I want to lament with others. And instead, we're just so good at all the other, we leap over lament, and we point fingers, and we blame, and we yell, and we get mad. And there are these other places in us that these traditions are the bearers of, not the only bearers of, but I feel like they are great resources and companions for now.
I wish there were a way, as we think about the time we're living through right now and how necessary it is for people to slow down, to take a deep breath, to think about their lives and the lives of those around them, to maybe explore some of the spiritual and religious practices and the great questions that haven't gone away just because we don't address them.
I'm with you. My quick definition of spiritual life is befriending reality.
Unpack that for us. Unpack that. That's great.
To befriend reality, which means all its complexity, right? We are all so complicated, and our life together is so complicated, and all of these challenges that we face are so complicated. But resisting that complexity doesn't get us where we want to go. And I think when I say that, befriending reality, also what I mean by that is that these traditions, Christianity, Buddhism, Judaism, Islam, Hinduism, they contain not just conversation and wisdom across time and generations about who God might be or what transcendence is, but this matter of being human, the complexity of being human. And so much of what the traditions have taught and cultivated is now being borne out in our disciplines of neuroscience and social psychology. So, you know, one of the things we're learning is the corrosive effect that fear has. When human beings are afraid, we are literally unable to rise to our best selves, right? It's literally too much to ask of somebody.
That's right. The system is overwhelmed.
Yeah, can't do it. Mm-hmm. If you feel threatened, the feeling of threatened is enough. You may not actually be in danger. So that's reality. And so the pragmatism of these spiritual tools and practices and teachings is that it gives us the power to settle into our best selves. This move of not letting fear dominate, of finding ways to control that in ourselves, to step into our best selves, to transmit to others that that is possible, to move through the world that way, we cannot face the challenges before us. We cannot face how we have distorted ourselves with this construction of race, right? I mean, to name just one of the things that is before us, which kind of underpins so many of the others, if we don't find ways to rise into the best and deepest and most complex aspects of our humanity and character, our moral imagination.
Oh, I feel literally thrilled by that phrase, befriending reality, and your description of what it means, what it could mean. That really is just truly music to my ears, Krista. We'll be back right after this quick break.
You know, I will say, since I'm here with you, I know, and I've known this, but I hear it in your voice, even though you're mostly just asking questions now. But I know that this is a huge part of you, the tradition you grew up in, that there is a religious and spiritual grounding to your life that I assume has evolved, because I think if this part of life, like anything, if you're alive, it's evolving, and you have had an adventurous life. And I just think it must have been, I have thought this before, it must have been frustrating for this, even this part of yourself, to not be able to show, because as we've talked about, there's not a place where the complexity and richness and fullness of this part of us gets honored and has a place to show itself. I don't know if that's a question, but...
Well, no, but I take it as a question, because it's one that I've thought about a lot. Mm-hmm. I was raised as a Methodist. I was raised, going to Sunday school. I had a really influential youth minister who took us to a different level of thinking about life and what it meant to be a Christian, what it meant to be a person of faith. He was the one who took me as a young teenager to hear Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. speak. And he was constantly challenging us with art and poetry and different ways of thinking about the world than the ones we had grown up with in our suburb of Chicago. And so I always believed that faith was a constant in my life. You might hear the rain beating on the top of the roof of my my little attic office where I am recording this, which seems kind of appropriate. It was really difficult to ever express any of these feelings or experiences or even the questions raised by my own faith and my own upbringing and my own searching in my public life. For example, when my father died, I had given, several weeks of my time by his, bedside as he passed away. And I was just totally overwhelmed by what we all experience at the death of a loved one. And I had promised to speak at the University of Texas before my father's stroke, and I was trying to get out of it. And the indomitable Liz Carpenter, who had asked me to deliver the speech, said, "No, no, Hillary, you got to come. We filled the field house, tens of thousands of people. You have to come." Well, I had no idea what I was going to say. I didn't feel up to the occasion, but, I'm a dutiful Methodist person. And so, of course, I went. And it was an incredibly emotional experience for me. And I talked about meaning and life. And I remember just being ridiculed by the press. Mm. What right did I have to raise these issues in public? What was a, quote, first lady doing, talking about issues of life and death and meaning, and spirituality? It was a very, very difficult time in my life, and to feel that I had no public outlet for exploring these issues meant that I just became more personal. And
I see.
Only
so that was
about,
kind of you. You then decided you needed to keep that in. Yeah.
And in terms of a personal experience, it certainly has continued. But I have felt often that, maybe if I could think of a better way of talking about it, a more, understandable and acceptable way, I might possibly make a better impact. But, I feel very fortunate that I've had this grounding in faith, not just emotionally, but intellectually.
Yeah. Yes.
Because I have fallen back on it, time and time again. So it's challenging if you're in the public eye and known for being in the public eye as a political person. There's an acceptable range to talk about religion. But if you go into these deeper questions, the press and certain elements of the public get immediately anxious about it.
Yeah, we don't have the vocabulary. Yeah. I mean, I think
don't don't think it's somehow appropriate to have this conversation in public. Like, don't talk about this in public, for heaven's sakes.
Yeah. I also think that word you used, searching.
Mm.
The crazy thing is that the religion that does get somehow sanctioned is the certainty, right? It's the
yes.
It's the doctrinaire.
Yes.
And that's actually not how people live this. You described it. It's somebody dies. It's like these
right.
moments in life where
right.
it doesn't all add up. And
that's right.
And nothing else is there. This is where we are turned into our interior existence. Mm-hmm. And these questions of meaning, that makes so much sense what you just said. And it feels painful to me from afar. It's painful to hear about.
Well, thank you again for spending this time with me.
Thank you.
You can hear Krista Tippett every week. Tune in to On Being from Minnesota Public Radio and PRX. I want to turn now to someone else who has shed new light on the issue of faith, in his case, through humor.
Christianity. It's the dominant religion in our country. But did you know it's also in serious trouble? No, it's not gays, not science, not liberal Hollywood. According to Alabama, it's Sharia law.
Asif Manvi is perhaps best known for his role as The Daily Show's senior Muslim correspondent. Or alternatively, the senior foreign-looking correspondent. He was also the lead actor and co-writer and producer of the web series Halal in the Family. What a great name. They say if you want to make people think, try making them laugh, and that's exactly what Asif does, all while confronting racism, xenophobia, Islamophobia, and bigotry. And then there's the latest development. This past March, Asif became a dad, and of course, I wanted to hear all about that. So before we get started on all this other stuff, what's your son's name?
His name is Ishan Amir Manvi. My wife is Hindu and I'm Muslim. So Ishan is a Hindu name, Amir is Muslim, and his initials are I Am, which is, Jewish.
Uh-huh.
Yahweh. So we got all the bases covered, you know.
You're like a walking advertisement for
exactly
for religious tolerance.
Major religions, exactly. No, it was actually amazing because we had an interfaith wedding, a Hindu Muslim wedding, and we had to make it up because, you know, there's a world in which Shefali and I would never have gotten married, you know.
That's right. And how did you grow up? I mean, I know you spent part of your childhood in the UK, then your family moved to Florida. How did it feel to you growing up Muslim in those two settings?
Well, you know, I did grow up Muslim and I grew up in a relatively religious home. My grandparents were religious, you know, so Islam was always just part of the DNA of my childhood. You know, maybe not ironically, but interestingly, it didn't really become a thing until after 9/11. Up until then, I had this religion that felt very private, and it felt like it was my thing that I did with my family. We went to the mosque sometimes. We prayed at home, you know. We went to religious ceremonies and things, but it never became something that was looked on from the outside until after 9/11. And then suddenly, there was a different relationship to it, and suddenly I was dealing with the explanation of it or having to somehow defend it or somehow, you know, Islam became politicized. But growing up, it just felt like it was a very personal, private thing. And I used it as my own way of connecting with whatever higher spirit, you know, God, the universe, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm. When you think about politicizing religion and then the Islamophobia that resulted after 9/11, you have been one of the very few high-profile people who have walked right into that. You and I want to understand your thinking about it because you know, I'm sure that there were people who said, you know, don't go there, you know, don't make it an issue. How did you come to grips with what you wanted to do to try to, you know, in your own way, combat what you saw as the politicization and the really demonization in so many different quarters of Islam?
Well, you know, it's funny because I was, sometimes life just happens to you. And what you do in that moment defines what happens in the next moment. And for me, what happened, I wasn't trying to be political. I wasn't trying to like be outspoken about it. Even after 9/11, I was dealing with it on a personal level, but never in a public forum. And then The Daily Show happened for me. I got this job that I never expected to get. I wasn't looking for it. It literally happened. I went to this audition. Jon Stewart hired me, and suddenly I was now the Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show, much to the terror of my parents, who I remember my dad saying to me, listen, if Jon Stewart ever asks you anything about Islam, you just have him call your mother because you don't know a damn thing. And so, like, and so they were terrified that I was going to be out there, like, just, you know, saying all kinds of nonsense that didn't make any. And then what it did for me was it gave me this platform. And at that time, in 2006, there were not a lot of people representing in that way that felt like it was truthful. I mean, you had, like, you know, the terrorist on 24, or, you know, I mean, I got so many scripts in the aftermath of 9/11 where it was literally the first scene of the movie or the TV show is the towers coming down and Muslims cheering and praying, every script. And so this was the first time there was something where, like, I thought, oh, this is an actual conversation. Like, we're actually talking about this. And I think that when I got on The Daily Show, I ended up there and I thought to myself, okay, this is what I'm going to end up being. And I realized, like, oh, there was a need for it. So I leaned into it. And then I found a voice around it. Then as I stepped into it further and further, I realized, oh, I'm actually finding a voice that I had not allowed myself to find. So sometimes it's just about being given the opportunity to express that. And then you realize, like, I got a lot to say. You know, I didn't know that I had this much to say around this.
Yeah. And let me sort of bring this back to both faith, but also fatherhood. So here you are, a new father, thinking about all that's going on in the world around you. How do you hope the world looks, you know, in 5 years when he starts school, in 18 years when he graduates from high school? And how do you see how raising your son at this moment is going to play out?
Well, I feel, I do believe, and you know, maybe this is the glass half full guy in me, which is that I do believe that after a breakdown, there is a breakthrough. And if we're going through some kind of sort of profound breakdown, there is going to be a moment of breakthrough. And I also believe something that I discovered recently, which is the difference for me between faith and belief, you know? And belief is, I believe something is going to happen. I believe that I'm going to get that job, or I believe that I'm going to, you know, be whatever it is. Faith is understanding that no matter what happens, I have the capacity to move forward and to be okay. And that is something that I feel like I want my son to understand. It's a much more difficult thing to inhabit, which is this idea that, like, I'm going to be, and we will be okay no matter what happens. Mm-hmm. And that is faith. Mm-hmm. And that we cannot be destroyed, because faith is larger than adversity, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I love that. And I'm with you in hoping that, you know, this breakdown leads through a breakthrough.
Yeah.
But I just can't thank you enough. I've loved talking to you. I just wish the best for you and your wife and your son.
Thank you so much. This has been such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
When he's not changing diapers, Asif Manvi has his hands in many new projects, including a highly entertaining new supernatural drama series called Evil on CBS. Check it out. You and Me Both is brought to you by iHeartRadio. We're produced by Julie Subrin and Kathleen Russo, with help from Huma Abedin, Nikki Etour, Oscar Flores, Brianna Johnson, Nick Merrill, Lauren Peterson, Rob Russo, and Lona Valmoro. Our engineer is Zach McNeese. Original music is by Forrest Gray. If you like You and Me Both, don't keep it to yourself. Tell a friend. You can subscribe to You and Me Both on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. While you're there, leave us a review. I'd really appreciate it. We'd love to hear from you, so send us your questions, comments, or ideas for future shows at youandmebothpod@gmail.com. Come back next week when we're talking to some amazing women leaders, including the one and only Gloria Steinem.